Many people. The Cuban people, but many friends here in this country and around the globe. And I think it's a victory. It has to be recognized as a victory for us, for our people, and for all those who were opposing the U.S. policies during this half a century. At the same time, it should be recognized the merit of President Obama for having realized that it was high time to abandon a policy that he himself recognized as a failure. It's still, we have come a long way, but there is still a long way to go ahead of us. But for the first time, it will be the Americans and Cubans dealing with each other on an equal footing. Something very important, Amy, that I think that everybody should remember. Last Saturday, the United States was the only country in the Western Hemisphere who didn't have an embassy in Havana. And Cuba was the only country in the Western Hemisphere without an embassy here. Now, what has happened is that the U.S. has joined the rest of Latin America and the Caribbean. This story began when the U.S. succeeded in isolating Cuba from the rest of the hemisphere. And now, the first chapter has ended with the U.S. ending its isolation from the rest of the continent.
How did it happen?
You should not overstate the role of diplomats, the professional, the real force that brought about this result was the struggle of the peoples. First of all, the Cuban people, for having resisted for so long time all the odds that U.S. policy imposed upon us, but also a victory for the rest, the resistance of the rest of the peoples in this hemisphere, including many, many American friends.
You have been a diplomat for decades.
Yeah.
Cuba was just taken off the list of terrorist nations in the United States. How does that feel, not to be considered a terrorist anymore?
Frankly speaking, if you had asked Nelson Mandela how did he feel about being in that list, Mandela was considered a terrorist probably for a longer period of time. His entire life, when he was in prison, when he got out of prison, when he was elected president of South Africa, when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, he was on the list of the State Department list of terrorists. And they took him out in 2008, I suspect, because they were suspecting Mandela was going to die, and was going to die in that infamous list. By the way, it was a senator from Massachusetts, now Secretary of State, who said at that time that it was a shame in the U.S. policy to have that list, and in that list, people like Mandela. In the list or not being in the list, it doesn't matter. The embargo is a matter of other laws, other different laws that has to be removed.
Longtime Cuban diplomat Ricardo Alarcón has died at the age of 84. He was speaking on Democracy Now! In 2015 in Washington, D.C., after the Cuban embassy was reopened there for the first time in 54 years. The Trump administration put Cuba back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism in 2021. Biden has not reversed President Trump's reversing Obama's normalization process for Cuba. To see the whole interview, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine a recent federal ruling that says that, more likely than not, Donald Trump, former president, has committed federal crimes.
We are joined today by Professor Michael Tiger, an expert in these issues, to help us sort this out. Stay tuned.
Today we also get an expert's analysis of the way in which the mainstream media is reporting on the war.
No one is more adept than our guest, Norman Solomon, in unpacking the lies of the major media.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. There is a great deal of speculation as to whether former President Donald Trump will eventually be indicted for crimes allegedly committed while he was the president. Well, in what might prove to be the most serious blow yet to Trump's efforts to stay out of jail, on March 28th, a federal judge ruled that both former President Trump and attorney John Eastman, who had advised him on how to overturn the 2020 election, had most likely committed felonies, including obstructing the work of Congress and conspiring to defraud the United States. The ruling represents a highly significant breakthrough for the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Judge David O. Carter found that the actions taken by Trump and Eastman amounted to, and I quote, a coup in search of a legal theory, close quote. The judge's ruling may be the House committee's biggest win to date, as it suggests that the investigators have already built a case strong enough to convince a federal judge of Trump's culpability in the January 6th insurrection. Specifically, the ruling means that the House committee will now receive more than 100 emails related to the legal strategy proposed by Eastman to pressure Vice President Mike Pence not to certify electors from swing states when Congress convened on January 6th, and thus to not certify the electoral vote. In making his ruling, Judge Carter said, and again I quote, Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history. Well, just how significant is this federal court ruling? What would a federal prosecutor need to show a judge and jury to be able to hold Trump liable for his actions around January 6th? And what about other actions by the former president while in office that many criminal law experts claim were also illegal? And of course, what role will politics ultimately play in determining whether Trump ever stands trial and is convicted by a jury? Now, to help us sort all of this out, we are indeed fortunate today to have as our guest, attorney and professor Michael Tiger. Professor Tiger has been acting professor of law at UCLA, the Joseph D. Jamels Chair of Law at the University of Texas, and the holder of an endowed professorship at Washington College of Law. He is the author of numerous books, including Thinking About Terrorism, The Threat to Civil Liberties in Times of National Emergency. And he has represented such notable clients as the Washington Post, Representative Ron Dellums, and activist attorney Lynn Stewart. Professor Michael Tiger, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
As the House of Representatives Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol continues to, well, amass evidence against those involved in the attempted insurrection, U.S. District Judge David Carter issued an extraordinary 44-page opinion that said it was more likely than not that Donald Trump committed federal crimes. I wonder, Professor Tiger, if you'd indicate for us what those two crimes were the judge spoke of.
The first first was obstruction of an official proceeding, corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding, a part of the series of obstruction statutes that run from 18 United States Code Section 1503 up to about 1515. Then the second was a conspiracy to defraud the United States, which is a concerted agreement to frustrate and undermine the exercise of a legitimate governmental function. We could go on and on about that. People that are on the Internet, just Google 384 United States Reports. That's U.S. 855, and that's a primer in the Supreme Court, what that is.
Judge Carter also concluded that it was more likely than not that John Eastman committed a federal crime. Who is Eastman, and what is his connection to Trump and the attempted January 6th insurrection? What was Eastman's plan to subvert the election results?
Eastman's plan was that Trump would compel or coerce Mike Pence into simply refusing to carry out his constitutionally mandated duty, which is to open a bunch of envelopes and announce what the electoral results were. And that if Pence simply refused to do that, then the total votes wouldn't be counted and the result would be that Trump would win the election. It was, we talk about the lawyer-client privilege. You know, it's the kind of the dingbat client privilege here when we think about that theory. But Trump was all for it, and it amounted to an attempt to obstruct the official congressional proceeding, that is to say, the vote count. And also, if you look more broadly, at this conspiracy to defraud the United States.
Professor, I'm wondering this as well, and thinking of the court's opinion that we're now talking about, a lawful arrest requires probable cause that the suspect committed a crime. How does the phrase more likely than not compared to the probable cause standard, and why is this significant?
More likely than not is stronger than probable cause. All probable cause requires is the honest and strong suspicion that an offense has been committed and that a particular person committed it. So what we have here, when it's more likely than not finding, would, if followed through, the FBI could today go before a federal magistrate judge and swear out a criminal complaint and arrest Donald Trump and Professor Eastman. They're not going to do that. But that indicates, I think, the strength of the evidence that Judge Carter considered.
What connection is there between Judge Carter's opinion and the activities of the Select Committee? Does the committee have the power to bring criminal charges against Trump and Eastman?
All Judge Carter did was to uphold a subpoena issued by the Select Committee. The committee does not have the power to bring criminal charges against Trump and Eastman. That's up to the department that calls itself Justice. And that means that Merrick Garland has got to do something about that. That's why I think all of us ought to be looking at Garland and trying to exercise pressure to see that he does his job, because he's the one that has to take the next step.
Yeah, and that leads to our next question, really, Professor, is how likely is it, do you think, that the Select Committee will make a criminal referral to Attorney General Merrick Garland in the Department of Justice? And if the committee does make a referral, is the Justice Department obligated to bring criminal charges?
Okay, first, likelihood of criminal referral, pretty high if the Democrats maintain control of the House. Next to zero if they do not. The second question, no, the Department of Justice is not required to act on a criminal referral from Congress. That was a question settled some years ago by the D.C. Circuit.
There is a federal grand jury that is investigating the events of January 6th. What categories of people are they looking at?
From what we can tell, there are two categories. One, they are looking at how this January 6th insurrection got organized, who put it together, who got the people there, what kind of encouragement was done. And we know we have a pretty good idea of that because Chief Judge Howell has been commenting on the way the Department of Justice has been sifting through records. The second aspect of it is to take a look at the broader question, that is the legal issues that are posed by Judge Carter's truly significant opinion, and to climb the ladder and, you know, identify some major targets. What's disappointing is that I don't see a lot of evidence that the department is pursuing that second prong with the vigor that one would hope. And, you know, Merrick Garland is not known for being a courageous prosecutor. He is a very cautious person. He's had that reputation for decades. And it's a disappointment that the department is not proceeding with more vigor on that prong.
Yeah, and I wonder then, Professor, what do you think that Garland will consider in deciding whether or not to ask the grand jury to return a criminal indictment against Trump, given what you've just said?
I got to tell you, I know Merrick Garland because he allegedly spearheaded the government effort to prosecute Terry Nichols. So we've confronted each other in a court, and there's plenty of documentation that he's a cautious political animal. Has been for years. So he will consider all of those things about the potential disruptive effect of a prosecution of Donald Trump and other major leaders of the government.
We're speaking today with Professor Michael Tiger about possible criminal liability for Donald Trump. Professor Tiger, the Select Committee has received White House telephone logs that show a gap of 7 hours and 37 minutes during the time the January 6th attempted insurrection was taking place. Trump made at least one call on a White House phone that wasn't recorded on the call log. What does this remind you of? And could Trump's cover-up turn out to be worse than his crimes?
Well, it reminds me of Richard Nixon's secretary having destroyed a part of the Nixon tapes. But it also reminds me of so many cases in which malefactors who stood a good chance of being acquitted set themselves up for surefire conviction by tampering with evidence, destroying documents, and putting pressure on witnesses. This is the classic activity of the obstructor of justice, and it leads not only to independent criminal liability, but to an inference of an intent to commit wrongdoing in the principal case.
Yeah, and I wonder too, Professor, the Select Committee has, of course, voted to recommend to the Justice Department that it file criminal contempt of Congress charges against various Trump allies. Please explain what is happening with those referrals, if you can.
Those referrals will probably be acted upon. The federal contempt of Congress statute, 2 United States Code, Section 192, is, of course, familiar to us old lefties because It's when you didn't answer questions before the Committee on Un-American Activities what they prosecuted you for. In order to charge somebody under that statute, there has to be an indictment. United States attorneys have been very diligent about following up on those congressional referrals.
The New York Attorney General has asked a New York State judge to hold Trump in civil contempt for failure to turn over documents for the Attorney General's investigation. What is the basis for that investigation, and what are the consequences of being held in civil contempt?
Civil contempt simply means that you can be held in custody or required to pay a fine, a sum of money every day until you comply. The New York AG's investigation, as I understand it, focuses on the financial dealings, Trump's financial dealings. For us in New York, the more significant thing is the Manhattan District Attorney, who has announced that their investigation is alive and well, and it is exploring many, many aspects of Trump's behavior. So both the state and the Manhattan investigations are worth following.
Mm-hmm. You know, Professor Michael Tiger, I guess the ultimate question, obviously, with respect to former President Trump is, will he ever be held accountable for his, well, what many of us think, many crimes? Will the ultimate decision be legal in this regard, do you think, or political?
ultimately, the best chance of that is either the Manhattan DA, who does have some courage, or, as I've said, Merrick Garland, the Department of Justice. I got to tell you, I don't know the answer to that. I don't have a great deal of confidence in this Department of Justice to do its job.
Professor Tiger, if Donald Trump were charged with federal offenses or state offenses as well, what do you think would happen? Do you think he would be convicted by juries, or do you think they would respond to the political tides and hesitate to convict? And I know you're looking at a crystal ball here, but I just want to get your thoughts.
Well, I've tried cases in Manhattan, and I've tried cases in the District of Columbia. I don't fancy Trump's chances before a District of Columbia jury. I think they read him pretty clearly. And Manhattan juries also, you know, they come because they're New Yorkers. You know, they got a crap detector strapped on that detects that sort of thing. If he's indicted in either of those jurisdictions, based on what we know about the evidence, I don't see his chances as being very good of escaping liability.
But what if he elected to not have a jury trial?
Well, you know, in order to waive a jury trial in federal court, you need the permission of the judge. And the Supreme Court has held that that permission can be withheld for any reason at all. Now, so I don't see very many federal judges that are willing to let him waive a jury and to take the heat of trying the case without a jury.
Professor Tiger, there are so many moving parts to this investigation in the House of Representatives, in the federal grand jury, in the Department of Justice, in the state proceedings. What is most significant to you about this process, and what do you predict will happen ultimately?
The best chance to hold Trump liable is what we've seen in Judge Carter's opinion. Here is a judge, a federal judge, and remember what Trump has said about federal judges that he disagrees with. He's insulted the process. He's insulted Judge Carter's colleagues. He's shown his contempt for the judicial system. And judges have long memories. So I don't fancy his chances in the ongoing litigation. With respect to whether the select committee is going to continue, that I don't know. But the best chance to hold Trump accountable lies in either of two forums. As I say, one is the federal grand jury in the district, and the other is in Manhattan. And I want to say this, Merrick Garland or some of his friends are listening. You know, within a month after the Oklahoma City bombing, the FBI had taken 85,000 witness statements, and a federal grand jury was hard at work. I don't see equivalent amounts of energy put towards this attempt to take control of the government by a coup. And I think that Merrick Garland should be held accountable for that.
Why do you think that it has taken so long to get anything definitive from this committee, which has been functioning for months?
Well, congressional committees are notoriously inefficient as fact gatherers. And the Republicans are actively obstructing at every turn. So that's the best explanation I can give there. But with respect to the federal grand jury, as I see, I think there's a certain amount of timidity here. We're just not seeing the level of activity by federal law enforcement that we might expect to see.
And do you think that's a function of not being pushed heavily enough by the Attorney General, by Merrick Garland?
I do. And, you know, as I say, Merrick Garland is a member of a group of a political cadre in Washington, D.C. that made its way to positions of power through extraordinary caution in the face of controversy. We saw it in the Oklahoma City case. We've seen it in other instances. So that's what's going on. I think there's a lack of leadership.
Yeah, I would add to those examples that you've used as well, and Marjorie knows about this as well as I do. We've covered this topic of Julian Assange and the prosecution of Julian Assange on this program a number of times. And again, despite the fact that Garland now knows, well, the world now knows that there are actual recordings of then CIA Director Pompeo and Trump discussing how to actually murder Julian Assange in order to make sure that he is no longer a thorn in their side, and all the rest that's involved in the case. And yet Garland, as far as we can tell, has not done anything, and a great deal of pressure is being put on him to do something. And so we share that, those of us who are very concerned about Julian Assange share that same concern about Garland that you've expressed with whether or not he's likely to do anything definitive with respect to the former president.
Well, as you may know, my wife Jane and I were expert witnesses for the defense in the Assange extradition proceedings. You pointed out a great contrast, and that is when so-called national security is at stake, all these folks come and salute the flag. You know, you can't litigate question of renditions. We're going to prosecute Assange for everything. We're going to let a rogue prosecutor out of Northern Virginia loose on him, and so on. But when it comes time to face political corruption on this scale that Judge Carter has very courageously identified, there's this kind of unaccustomed timidity about governmental power, power that we see so amply exercised when it comes to going after Assange.
Mike, Barack Obama, who was certainly famous for his timidity, was responsible for prosecuting more people, more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined. But when Obama's Department of Justice convened a secret grand jury to decide whether to indict Julian Assange, they decided against it because of what is called the New York Times problem, because WikiLeaks and Julian Assange did what other organizations in the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Der Spiegel, Le Monde did, which was to publish classified information. And what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did, which really incurred the ire of the Trump administration, and apparently now the Biden administration, is to reveal evidence of U.S. war crimes. So along comes Donald Trump, who exercises no such forbearance the way that Obama did, and swears out a secret indictment against Julian Assange, which then becomes public. Assange is facing 175 years in prison if he's extradited to the United States from the U.K. and tried and convicted of these charges. But why do you think that Biden, who loves to attach his coattails to his friend Barack, has continued to pursue this appeal of the denial of extradition vigorously? Why hasn't Merrick Garland and Biden and presumably the CIA involved in this decision dropped these charges against Julian Assange and dropped the request for extradition? Your thoughts.
One. You make a very good point. Not prosecuting journalists, and Julian Assange is a journalist, was a watchword in the Department of Justice until the Assange case, undermined then by actions taken by the Obama administration. This administration, for a number of reasons, not all of which I'm aware of, is beholden to the intelligence agencies. And they have decided to resume this process, and it isn't just the Assange case. In the Zubaydah case, they took a position on state secrets that is quite simply outrageous. They've taken an outrageous position on the death penalty in the Tsarnaev case. And really, if you want, Ketanji Brown Jackson, as a district judge, supported the CIA in a very significant judicial opinion that was in a case brought by some of my law students seeking to get evidence of governmental illegality. So there is, despite we may applaud that appointment, but the fact is that this administration has returned to the Obama administration activity about which you spoke. And it gives one pause about the opportunity for meaningful judicial review when national security is invoked.
when the government invokes national security, is there any way that a judge can really test the accuracy of that claim? I mean, the government could say that whenever it wants. National security, this is a state secret.
Yes, that's the problem. We read the Zubaydah case. There, there's an old Supreme Court case that says judicial control over the evidence in the case should not be abandoned to the caprice of executive officers. While playing lip service to that, the Supreme Court in the Zubaydah case says, no, you can't litigate, leading the dissenting judge to say, wait a minute, these alleged secrets are things we already know about. There are a few shining examples of judges that are willing to look behind questions of national security. Learned Hand was one in the Copeland case, 185 Federal 2nd 629. But, you know, usually the answer has been no, no, no. And, for example, it is a lasting reproach to our country that we had the Japanese incarceration, the wrongfulness of which wasn't acknowledged for 40 years. We, as litigating lawyers, have got to continue to try to battle the secrecy, which is invoked supposedly to protect the nation, but was in fact a cover for mendacity and illegality.
I'm among those, but more importantly, many historians are writing and talking about the fact that when we look at what is happening with respect to the new Jim Crow, when we look at what is happening in a number of state legislatures in terms of what they're doing around voting rights as well, what we're looking at, in fact, numerous court decisions restricting in a variety of ways the right to protest and what have you. When we look at the role that money plays in politics, well, all of the things that we are aware of that challenge any democracy, that today we are on the threshold of losing that democracy and leaving ourselves with an autocracy at best. Do you share that concern, or do you believe those of us that have that concern are overreacting to where the country seems to be going in recent years?
No, they're not overreacting, and I share the concern. The question then is, what do we do about it? And good, clear voices, like, you know, read Marjorie Cohn. Every time you see she's written something, go ahead and read it.
Absolutely.
And share it with your friends. I tried to, in my book, Sensing Injustice, that sort of memoir, to lay out a sort of social history of what that involved understanding what we as lawyers can do. You know, it took many years and many efforts to eventually bring about the Supreme Court decision about segregation. And even, of course, Brown v. Board of Education turned out to be not so effective until the direct action movement involved people taking to the streets to demand justice. So the answer is that we lawyers continue to have the obligation to speak truth to power, and that we may find in this time to be that we will once again have to be defending people who have spoken truth to power in the streets and who are in trouble because of it.
Well, Professor Michael Tigard, thank you so much. It's been very enlightening, and we so appreciate you joining us today on Law and Disorder. I wonder, how can our listeners follow your work, find your books, and so forth?
Well, the book is Sensing Injustice, A Lawyer's Life in the Battle for Change. That's a social history. As I said, you got to read Marjorie Cohn all the time. You got to follow that advice that says, don't mourn, organize. I'm an octogenarian now, so the other people got to take this up. You know, I used to chase justice like a dog chased cars. Now I just sit on the porch and bark at it as it goes by.
I don't think so.
Mike Tiger, you're one of the best guests we've ever had.
Absolutely.
Particularly because you're touting
It was so nice to see you again. You gave us such a wonderful time in San Diego. Jim Lafferty, good to talk to you again.
Yes. All
Hope
right.
to see you all soon.
We'll have you back soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
And now to the matter of Russia's war in Ukraine and the role of a free press in wartime. Today, much is made of the fact that in Putin's Russia, little or no accurate news of the war is reaching the Russian people. Instead, what they read in their newspapers or hear on their radios and see on their TVs is no more nor less than what Putin wants them to read, see, or hear. Meanwhile, here in the United States, the American people are provided with virtually nonstop newspaper and especially live television coverage of the war in Ukraine. Coverage that comes from reporters and others, often in real time and on the ground in the middle of Putin's war in Ukraine. Surely the dramatically contrasting way in which the Russian people and the American people are experiencing the war via the media must play a major role in how the two peoples feel about the war. So, too, how the U.S. war in Iraq and Afghanistan were covered by the U.S. media must have played a role in how we, the American people, felt about those wars. Well, today we look at the role a nation's media can play in shaping public support for or against a war that is being fought by that nation. And I can think of really no better guest to help us unravel the answer to this question than our guest today. He is Norman Solomon, certainly one of America's true champions of a free and honest press, free and honest in wartime as well as in peacetime. Mr. Solomon is a longtime associate of FAIR, or Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which has proved to be a powerful watchdog of the American media. Norman Solomon is the co-founder of the online activist organization RootsAction.org, and he is also the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is, of course, as well, the author of really too many articles to recite here, and he is also the author of a number of books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and also the book Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Norman Solomon, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
And Norman, in your book, War Made Easy, you lay out in considerable detail how the powers that be manipulate the media so that it can serve as a propaganda tool for the government to use in selling its war to the American people, and how the American people, though, if they employ the right guidelines, can distinguish between the government's propaganda and the truth about the war. So talk to us about this and about the guidelines we should employ so as not to be fooled by false and misleading news about a war the U.S. is fighting, like the war in Iraq or Russia's war now in Ukraine.
It's really an imperative for us to understand that wartime is a time of propaganda. The first casualty of war, as the saying goes, is truth. And whenever we face an onslaught of media messaging, the sources are really crucial. There can be a new style which has evolved in the recent decades. We don't have news reports that sound like editorials. They simply give sourcing only to people with a particular point of view. And in case of U.S. foreign policy, it's not only officials of the U.S. government, it's also selected experts from academia, from think tanks on Capitol Hill, and so forth. And so it's really an ongoing challenge for us to see that politics is war by other means and vice versa, that messaging is constant, coming from where? Coming from corporate media, by which I would include NPR News and PBS NewsHour and so forth. So calling something public broadcasting doesn't eliminate the reality of government and corporate influence and deference. We say that media are deferring to government and war makers. Sometimes it's difficult to tell the difference because there's such a revolving door, not only literally between, say, the Pentagon and lawmakers and media, but also a way in which a mentality is a revolving door, the assumptions. And I think that's something else that I would just underscore, that the assumptions of reporting, even though they are silent, can be more powerful than even what is said. And just one example, the assumption that the United States government has the right, the prerogative, the privilege that is appropriate to attempt regime change, whether through through the CIA or through military intervention, that is an assumption that is widely held in the U.S. news media. And even though it is, well, assumed, it's silently accepted, that still means it's very, very powerful.
Before we move on a bit, some of the guidelines, want to be sure if we, do you think you've covered those for us enough in terms of what we can do to be aware of it other than read your book and
well, I would say alternative sources are crucial. And so, yes, we should monitor mainline media, whether it's the LA Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, or NPR News, or major networks. And sometimes they provide very useful reporting. At the same time, it's like a diet that's or a monoculture. If you're only acclimating yourself to the mainstream mainline media, you're missing out on a lot. So finding credible sources online, I always recommend commondreams.org, for instance. That's very helpful. If you were to, say, listen to, for instance, Morning Edition or All Things Considered on NPR, and also every day watch or listen to Democracy Now! And read commondreams.org, then you've got the bifocals on. Then you're not just looking through one lens grind at the world, and you have a way to contrast and compare. And frankly, we live in a very Orwellian media climate, particularly when it comes to war and peace. And if we're able to do that contrasting and comparing, we can see the contradictions much more clearly.
Norman, your book titled Target Iraq is subtitled What the News Media Didn't Tell You. What would you say were the more important facts about the U.S. war in Iraq that the mainstream news media did not tell the American people?
In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, which is when Reese Ehrlich and I wrote the Target Iraq book, it came out 2 months before the invasion, there was so much blather, so much cross-pollination of lies and deception between the Fourth Estate, the news media, and the three branches of government, particularly Congress and Capitol Hill, that we were basically awash in lies and propaganda. And a lot of that was the United States had clean hands in the Middle East. For instance, the U.S. is and has been for so many decades closely aligned with a nuclear power in the Middle East. Israel, which imprisoned the whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu for a couple of decades for exposing that Israel had nuclear weapons. And so when the drumbeat was coming up before the invasion through Cheney and Bush and U.S. corporate media that, oh, we must make sure that there not be weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, in the possession of Iraq, what was not acknowledged was, and the U.S. government still does not formally acknowledge, that Israel has nuclear weapons. So that was one hypocrisy. The other was simply that there were so many experts who were raising questions and were available for interviews to challenge the idea that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so when you had, for instance, the phony hearing that was chaired by Joe Biden as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the midsummer of 2002, the only experts that he allowed, quote-unquote experts, were ones who were recommending an invasion of Iraq. So as is so often the case, what was missing was vigorous debate and going beyond the official sources of those who were supporting warlike policies.
You mentioned the possession of nuclear weapons by Israel, but has there been much media coverage about the very real danger of nuclear war now that the United States is supporting this proxy war in the Ukraine?
Well, it was really notable that in his State of the Union message just days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which is totally indefensible and we should condemn that invasion, we had President Biden speak at length about the invasion and how the United States would respond. There was no mention by the president in that speech of nuclear weapons. There was no mention of the president about the dangers of nuclear war. He completely detoured around what now, according to a Harris poll, 69% of the U.S. public is worried about, which is the increasing dangers of nuclear war. We have the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which 10 years ago said that the world was 6 minutes from apocalyptic midnight, and now it's 100 seconds from apocalyptic midnight, according to the doomsday clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. So what we're getting from the U.S. government, from the top throughout Congress, unfortunately, with very few exceptions, is whistling past the nuclear graveyard that awaits us if we don't have a change in policy. And certainly when you have U.S. and Russia in increasing tension and conflict and bombast, and the mobilization of NATO troops along the border of Russia in Eastern Europe, when you have these horrible killings from the air and with rockets by Russia in Ukraine, with all of this going on, to refuse to acknowledge and address the dangers of nuclear war, which have increased, is completely irresponsible. And that irresponsibility is shared in the U.S. by the President of the United States and by corporate media, which rarely address it.
Yes. You know, today, thanks to advancements in technology, the American people, of course, can turn on their TV sets, and as we've been doing, and watch round-the-clock coverage of Putin's war in Ukraine. We see the vastly destroyed infrastructure. We see the bombs actually hitting their targets. We see the grieving widows and children, the dead bodies with their hands tied behind their backs. We hear the recordings of Russian soldiers talking about their admitted rapes and killings of civilians. We see the massive exodus of Ukrainian people trying to flee the war. But we saw nothing like that during the U.S. war in Iraq, did we? All the average American knew about the war in Iraq was that it was supposedly to stop terrorism and get rid of a brutal dictator. But Norman, I can't help but wonder how much quicker the U.S. war in Iraq might have ended had CNN and all the rest of the media covered the war the same way they're covering the Ukrainian war. Norman, your thoughts on this matter? Am I simply mixing apples and oranges or what?
Well, we need to have a single standard of human rights and a single standard of condemning war crimes. A single standard is exactly what is missing in U.S. mass media and in the official Washington that it's so interlaced with. And so we're now facing, with this onslaught of coverage of the war crimes in Ukraine, the vast contrast, as you allude to, with the lack of coverage of the suffering, the deaths, the maiming, the agony that the United States caused in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. So this is a sort of a basic hypocrisy. It's a way that was described by George Orwell in his depiction of what he called doublethink, that certain facts are put on the shelf and then taken off only to the extent that it is useful in the sort of hiding of reality or not, and then put back on the shelf. And so the world, and I think humanity, and that includes many people who are disturbed by the contradiction in the United States, we are crying out for, we are demanding that there be a single standard so that we are not told we must see the world through a lens that is tinted red, white, and blue. We don't think that anybody living in Ukraine or in Iraq or in Afghanistan is more or less a human being than the other people living in those countries. That would seem to be natural. It would seem to be, well, of course. And yet, to have that single standard in U.S. media as a reporter, as a major pundit, is almost truly unacceptable. It is such a routine hypocrisy that we see it as normal scenery, and unfortunately, we often don't even give it a second thought.
You know, this discussion reminds me of the plight of the truth-telling investigative journalist Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks, Julian is presently sitting in a maximum security prison, Belmarsh in London. He's charged with espionage by the United States. He's awaiting extradition. He'll be tried in the Eastern District of Washington and most likely convicted of espionage. He faces 175 years in prison. While Assange was not able to see the war from the ground in Iraq, he did receive and publish tens of thousands of classified documents pertaining to the U.S. war in Iraq and elsewhere. And these documents established the fact that the U.S. and its allies were guilty of massive war crimes in the conduct of their war in Iraq. Had the New York Times and the rest of the American media published or disclosed these documents, as they did with the Pentagon Papers during the war in Vietnam, might not the American people have turned against the Iraq war even sooner than they did?
Well, really, when we look at what has been done to Julian Assange as an independent publisher, what was done to Chelsea Manning as a source for WikiLeaks, we see, and this is to put it mildly, how no good deed goes unpunished. And I would say in the case of Julian Assange, it's no great deed goes unpunished viciously by the U.S. government, in this case in tandem with the U.K. government. And so here we have truth-telling that is desperately needed and was provided by WikiLeaks under the leadership of Julian Assange, and that was infuriating to the people running the U.S. government, running the war machine, and truly, whether it was the Obama administration or the Trump administration, they had enormous hostility towards Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Top officials of the Obama administration condemned Assange using terms like he's a high-tech terrorist, and then Trump and his regime actually indicted Assange, which even the Obama administration was unwilling to do. It is so shameful that the most powerful media outlets in the United States, for instance, the New York Times or Washington Post, are refusing to scream bloody murder in defense of Julian Assange, even though what is being done to Assange as a publisher could, by the same rationale, be done to the New York Times and the Washington Post if the U.S. government took umbrage at what they published.
While America's wars are, well, they're certainly not good news for the young men and women sent to fight and die in them, or the American people whose tax dollars are being wasted and so forth, they are good news, are they not, for the vast industry of military hardware manufacturers. So I should think they're pleased with how the media today is covering Putin's war, and that it can't help but make the American people sympathetic, or does it, to America sending more and more military hardware to Ukraine. Your thoughts on how the media and corporate America in general, and particularly the weapons manufacturers, are they don't need to get together to conspire on this. They're on the same page.
Well, this is very much a topic that is almost entirely absent from the voluminous news coverage of the Ukraine war and the lead up to it by U.S. corporate media. And so you have a history which was laid out very well in Andrew Coburn's book, The Spoils of War, that came out a few months ago, that during the expansion of NATO, there were billions and billions of dollars worth of weapons that were sold to the new NATO countries. This was a new market for mostly U.S.-based corporations that were able to sell weapons to countries that were brought into NATO after the betrayal of a promise from the George Herbert Walker Bush administration to then the Soviet Union as it became Russia after the Berlin Wall fell, a promise that, and this is a quote, that NATO would not move one inch eastward. And rather than just one inch eastward, it has moved to almost a dozen countries, some of them up to the border of Russia, tremendously lucrative. And I think, you know, if we go back to that question of what wasn't told during the lead-up to the Iraq war. It also is related directly to what we haven't been told in recent months, that war is good for business, that the industry of providing weapons to kill and massacre people, usually civilians, is great for the bottom line. And you have corporations like Northrop Grumman making a killing, literally and figuratively. Their stocks go up when there's a new war. They thrive off of death. They thrive off of suffering. This is the nature of corporate capitalism. This is the nature of the military-industrial intelligence complex. And we in the United States or anywhere else in the world, we have the imperative to face the nature of these governments that are thriving from death and the corporations that make profits from it.
Indeed, indeed. Norman, the U.S. anti-war movement does not agree on how to view Russia's war in Ukraine. There are a number of split different decisions among different wings of the movement. And as a result, there has been very little protest over the U.S. and NATO military backing of Ukraine, the growing number of NATO and U.S. military bases in Europe at or near Russia's border, and of course the threat of a far wider war. Some in the anti-war mood argue that really the U.S. and NATO nations bear the lion's share of the blame for the war, given what you talked about in terms of the dishonoring of the U.S.-NATO agreement with the former Soviet Union as it was collapsing, not to expand NATO and take over the Warsaw Pact nations and so forth. Others argue that, yes, that played a role in why Russia invaded Ukraine, but, hey, this is Putin's war, and we should condemn it, as we also demand, perhaps, you know, certainly, that our NATO disband and so forth. So, Norman, what do you think the U.S. anti-war movement might be demanding with respect to the war in Ukraine that would bring the movement together and would call to the attention of the American people some of the issues they're not being aware of? And would you like to see a more united anti-war movement and taking to the streets around those issues than we've seen so far?
For starters, I would say that an anti-war movement should be anti-war. And if we've got folks who say, well, it's okay to invade certain countries and not others, to bomb cities and send rockets into populated areas, then it's not an anti-war movement. It's saying something else. We're at a time when, with so many billions of people on this planet, with the crying need to address the climate emergency, the mass starvation, the lack of potable water, the absence of health care for so many people on this planet, war should be made an anachronism. So I don't say this as a, quote, pacifist, because I'm not, but I do think that to accept war as just a natural occurrence, or to say there are good wars and bad wars, depending on which side or what team we're on, should be unacceptable. And in this case, it does go back, I think, to an underlying question of, are we going to have a single standard? You know, I think of the cross currents of ideologies that, as you allude to, can cause some people to say, well, this invasion and this slaughter of civilians is okay because of what led up to it. But I think of a saying among blues musicians that you might feel like you're getting lost, but you won't if you know the blues. And in politics, with all the cross currents of ideologies and national affiliations and loyalties, we might feel sometimes that we're getting lost, but we won't if we have a single standard. And I think that single standard, for instance, on the question of who are war criminals. George W. Yes. Bush, based on the evidence, was a war criminal. Barack Obama, who expanded the war in Afghanistan and continued it in Iraq, was a war criminal. Vladimir Putin is a war criminal. That's my own outlook, not just because I think it's an interesting thing to say, but I think it's based on what orders those leaders of those countries did implement to get their militaries to do such horrible things that have continued to cause so much suffering.
Norman, have progressive online news and opinion publications done all that they should be doing in the face of Russia's war in the Ukraine?
Well, I think there's always a challenge of access to resources and simply the people power and the time to do what is often very time-consuming, which is really quality journalism, analysis, aggregation of information, and if possible, to have correspondents on the ground to provide eyewitness reporting. And to give progressive outlets their due, there are usually very severe constraints in terms of resources. That said, I think that there's been some good reporting from progressive independent media outlets. At the same time, I think that, as I think it was Hemingway talked about, whether we're journalists or anybody else, we need a real BS detector. There's much more that could be done and should be done. To remember something that I.F. Stone said long ago, the great independent journalist, Stone said, "All governments lie, and nothing they say should be believed." I.F. Stone was not saying that governments lie all the time, but he was saying that we should be very skeptical when pronouncements come from government leaders telling us how they are saints and the other side is completely the opposite.
I know. I wonder, Norman, too, as I'm thinking about all of this and trying to find some good news today, I've been thinking that the growth of the fact that so many people, especially young people, are getting their news online as opposed to in a printed newspaper or anywhere else might be good news in terms of the ability to use the Internet. Of course, there are people left, right, and every other position on the Internet. But would you agree that it's leveled the playing field a bit?
The scholar Robert McChesney has pointed out that the Internet is dominated by the same corporate media forces that have dominated through ownership the so-called legacy traditional media. And if you do go to the list of the most trafficked websites, you find ones like the New York Times online. Mm-hmm. You find CNN, you find Axios and others, Politico. They are owned by vile billionaires or corporations that have pretty much the same orientation of traditional corporate media. So all the more important for us to support independent outlets, including, may I say, Law and Disorder, programs that bring us other voices, because if we don't support independent media, then they will not gain the strength that they deserve.
Norman, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but before we let you go, how can our listeners find your work these days?
Well, I'd really encourage people from a organizing standpoint to visit what my colleagues are doing at rootsaction.org. That's R-O-O-T-S action.org. We're an organizing and activism organization now with 1.2 million folks who are working together for progressive change. And also my writing is at normansolomon.com.
Wonderful. Well, Norman Solomon, I thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder. And my hat's off to you, frankly, for the wonderful work you've been doing for years now on behalf of honest journalism and journalism that brings the whole story to the American people.
Well, Jim and Michael, I really appreciate the chance to talk with you and with the listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
DePose from The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Just say that the Reuters bureau chief worked tirelessly to get the collateral murder video and the military light. They said they didn't have it, they couldn't find it, and then we only saw it when Chelsea Manning very courageously gave it to WikiLeaks to publish. Until that time, the narrative that the military had spun out about that incident was a complete fiction. It was a lie.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges. Truth is the first casualty of war. In the old communist countries, comrades who fell out of favor with the party bosses were crudely cut out of photographs. Today, in the digital era, it's easy to electronically eliminate a person and/or their work. Take Chris Hedges. His show, On Contact, was aired on RT, a Russian state TV network. It was on YouTube when suddenly its 6-year archive of programs disappeared. Hedges said this, "I vanished. In totalitarian systems you exist, then you don't. I have a hard time seeing how a detailed discussion of Ulysses or the biographies of Susan Sontag and J. Robert Oppenheimer had any connection in the eyes of the most obtuse censors in Silicon Valley with Vladimir Putin." And then he warns, "If this happens to me, it can happen to you." Our guest today is Chris Hedges. He's an award-winning journalist who's reported from the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. Cornel West calls him the greatest radical writer and journalist of our generation. He writes a weekly column for Shearpost.com. He's the author of many books, including Death of the Liberal Class, Wages of Rebellion, and America, The Farewell Tour. I talked with him on March 28th. Welcome to the program. It's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, a couple of bookend quotes I'd like you to talk about. Truth is the first casualty of war, which is attributed to Senator Hiram Johnson, and Randolph Bourne's War is the Health of the State.
In wartime, everything is sacrificed for the cause. The press and most of the public always falls in line in a conflict. Challenging the dominant narrative, even if you're speaking truth, is unacceptable. It will see you marginalized. It's certainly been true over the Ukraine conflict, but it's true in every conflict. And Bourne's statement that war is the health of the state means that in wartime, the state, with the excuse of national security, can accrue to itself all sorts of power that it wouldn't in peacetime be able to express. Censorship, control of resources, everything has to be sacrificed for the war effort, so you can't have strikes. And of course, Bourne was speaking about the First World War. Woodrow Wilson was the kind of best exemplar of this. He used the war, and remember, he had campaigned in 1916, I believe. His slogan was, "He kept us out of the war." But once the war started, he passed the Sedition Act and the Espionage Act, which was used to shut down his left-wing critics like Eugene V. Debs, who he threw in prison. It was used later to deport Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, and others. It was used to shut down the newspaper The Masses. None of this had really anything to do with the war effort. It had to do with crushing the left. That sets the template for what happens in a conflict. It is not just about hunting out people who might